Yeah, this is the it's beach setup. So it's like still the iMac Pro.
Did you use your fancy carrying case again?
Not only did I use my fancy carrying case, but I took Underscore's recommendation and added for $35 a wheeled dolly to it, also known as a hand truck. And because you can get like foldable light duty ones that weigh like 6 pounds and fold up to be all flat and compact for like $35 on Amazon. So I got one of those. I carried it on the boat with the dolly like in the pocket. When it came time to carry it off the boat and walk it to the house like a half mile away, I just stuck the wheels on.
Did you discover luggage dollies? Is that what I'm coming in the middle of here?
Yes. Yes, I discovered dollies.
I use that one. I think I described using that to take my Thunderbolt 27-inch Thunderbolt display to and from the Apple store like 3 times. Remember when I had to do that?
Yeah. Like yes. Now, like if I have to take my iMac in again, like because you know I took my iMac in once before for the image retention stuff that I had for the previous iMac. Now I will definitely use this for that as well. Like this has now made my ridiculous iMac carrying case a lot more useful because it's just a simple, you know, two wheel. I didn't even get the big 4 wheel kind, just the basic 2 wheel kind. So it would fold up nice and small and it would be pretty lightweight itself. I didn't want like, you know, an extra 13 pounds of metal for just this thing to make it easier for me to carry something like something smaller and lighter was good. But yeah, it made it a million times easier. So now I'm even more a fan of the solution of bringing my iMac to the beach with wheels now. And I'm even less leaning in the direction of a Mac Pro now because the iMac Pro is proving to be such a good solution.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't even need that fancy case. It was like, I think actually the original box, if you still had it, is even better because it's like stiff, you know, so it's good. What I would use is have the little like bungee cords or whatever to wrap over the front of the thing, you know, just...
Actually, I have the original box. I didn't bring it, but I do have it. I also bought a bunch of bungee cords, but I didn't actually need them, and I sent them home with the next bag because the carrying case has straps, like it has like a shoulder strap, and if I made the shoulder strap as small as it goes, and that was basically a perfect strap to go over the handle of the dolly. Yeah. So it was very secure. It didn't wiggle or you know try to fall off at all.
Just so we don't get a million corrections, we should say that dollies have 4 wheels and hand trucks have 2.
Okay, so what I have is a hand truck then.
But I think everyone just calls them dollies, and we all know what we're talking about. But the pedants will be out and say, technically, that's a hand truck. Did you put a link to your thing? Because when we're talking about things for luggage size, it's different than the other thing anyway. But so maybe they have a different name when they're small.
It was the one that Amazon said was the best one.
Mine is like super old. I think mine is from the days before luggage had wheels. Do you guys remember that? Were you old enough to remember before luggage had wheels?
Yeah.
I didn't have wheeled luggage until a few years ago.
A few years ago. Oh, anyway, I thought that wheeled luggage came in sometime around my childhood. But before that, we had tons of suitcases that just had one handle on one side of them, and that's it. Oh, these are very fancy. Yeah.
Yeah, this is the Magna Cart Personal 150-pound capacity aluminum folding hand truck, black and red, $29.99, and it only weighs about 6 pounds. It's great, it collapses. It's really nice.
That's way more complicated than the one I have. When I have is like one half that number of parts, but it's the same thing. It's a metal frame with a fold down flap and 2 wheels, so it's not much to it.
And the wheels are rubberized, so like it moves really nicely. Like I was surprised how nice it was for how little it weighed and how little it cost.
Well, I am glad that you are in paradise on your beloved computer. You really think you're not going to buy at least one Mac Pro?
I mean, look, never say never. But and some people have suggested what seems like an obvious idea is leave the iMac Pro at the beach and buy a new Mac Pro for home. And that's like I can, you know, if I really want to do that, like I could do that, but it just seems wasteful. It seems like
it's like having 2 houses, only one of which you live in. I mean, you're worried about the Mac. Having 2 Macs seems wasteful.
Well, just
so wasteful.
Touche. But like it
John,
just
I love you.
It seems wasteful to buy something that has such a limited lifespan as a computer and to only use it like 3 months a year.
I think your real problem is like the reason it's so great for you to bring it is you take your computer that you were just using yesterday, you put it on a little dolly slash hand truck and you set it up and it's like you pick up right where you left off. Whereas if it was sitting in the other house, it would be like, well, it doesn't like have all my stuff and all my state. And you could try to do iCloud syncing and put your project into Dropbox or whatever, but like it'll never be the same as like this is the exact computer I was using yesterday and now I just turn it on in a new location and resume my work. So there's the syncing disadvantage because Apple has not yet fully embrace the idea that the computer is an empty shell and you log in and all your state gets pulled down from the network. They're getting closer to that, but they're not there yet.
Exactly. And that's like, I mean, this is why, like, I mean, look, this is why everybody uses laptops, right? Because, like, if you're willing to tolerate, like, yeah, it turns out we already have a kind of computer that you can bring everywhere you go, and it's always the same computer. But
laptops are garbage. We already know that.
But yes, laptops are garbage.
Hey, I was just thinking to myself earlier today, actually, that I wonder, even though I really love my iMac, which is, it's like 3 years old now. When was this? It's a 5K 27-inch late 2015, although I think I bought it early 2016. Anyways, I was thinking to myself earlier today, I wonder if I should just get myself a brand new laptop, because I feel like I really want to replace the Adorable, because it was slow when I bought it, and it's getting real bad now. And the iMac is fine, but it's getting a little long in the tooth. Maybe I should just go back to the laptop with, you know, an external display on the desk. And
what external display?
Well, that's problem number one.
Yes,
right?
Question number one.
is what external display? And I don't have a good answer for you there. But I don't know. Like, I do really like having the iMac here at the desk. And I feel like with Dropbox and GitHub and so many other online services these days, and Gmail or, you know, an equivalent, it's so easy to manage multiple computers in a way that it's never been easy before. And yet, I still kind of miss having just the one computer that is everything to, well, not to everyone, it's just me, but everything to everyone, so to speak, you know? And I don't know. I at the moment, I'm not upgrading anything, but I can't help but wonder, you know, the laptop-only life is calling to me a little bit. And I think the thing that's going to stop me from going there is, to your point, the display. I just don't have a good display.
Well, and also, like when you're in that world, like, you know, I spent a long time using a laptop as my only computer, or at least my primary one for a very long time. And it was great, especially in that way. Like, I didn't have to worry about syncing and everything and transferring files and making sure all my settings were the same and applications were the same. Like, all that stuff that's a pain, that much of which is still a pain today, I had to worry about none of that. But then, like, my computer had to go in for service, and I just didn't have a computer for, like, a week. there are problems like that that come up, too. And when you're using a laptop as a desktop, you run into the problems of doing that. You run into things like the unreliability of external monitor usage, and if you want to use it in clamshell mode, or things like wake from sleep are frequently unreliable. And you have issues with noise when you're running it really hot, you know, really hard, you're going to hear that fan spin up. And so, like, it's just... There's just problems with using laptops that way, some of which are better these days, like things like Dropbox and iCloud Sync, some of which are worse. Like, I think the laptops today are less reliable than ever when it comes to external monitor usage, and the number of good external monitors to buy is lower than ever.
One of the other fun pipe dreams, along with the modular Mac that's made of a bunch of stackable components that connect together, is the idea. I think it started gaining steam back in the iPod era. The idea that you have some small thing that you carry with you today. It would be a phone back then. It was an iPod. You could even imagine as just like an external SSD or something that contains all of your state, essentially. This is like before cloud computing was popularized. Just like it's like your hard drive, your boot disk, all your info, and you just go from station to station, whether it be a desktop station with a big monitor and a keyboard and a mouse, or a laptop or whatever, and you plug in your iPod, your phone, your external drive, and there's all your stuff. And so you carry the state with you in this little box, but you're able to use whatever the best computing setup is for you. It's almost, you know, dockable laptops are similar to that in hoteling situations and companies and stuff, but that fantasy that, like, my entire world will be on my phone, and I'll just sit down in front of my computer and wirelessly the phone will display onto a giant 27-inch display and all that stuff. Like, that's right up there with the modular Mac. And for various reasons, we're not quite there technologically speaking, but you can pull Jason Snell. He posted a picture the other day of, like, an external drive duct taped to the back of his display on his laptop. Like, if you just carried a boot drive with you, you could boot an iMac from that external drive and hollow all your state. Like, say it's a 1 terabyte SSD in a very small case. And then you could connect it to your laptop when you're on the go and boot from that and have it taped to the back of your display or something so it's not dangling off or whatever. And you still have basically a portable computer that is, like Marco's iMac Pro, it's like, the, quote unquote, the same computer as you had before. Although, of course, all your windows will be screwed up by constantly changing screen resolution. But if that doesn't bother you, there you go. So you can't approximate that with an external drive today. Can't do it with a phone. Certainly can't do it with an iPod. But the problem is, okay, well, what if I don't want to tape it to the back of my display? Do I really want to use a laptop with a thing dangling off of it that I can't disconnect because it is the boot drive? And, you know, as fast as USB-C is, it's not as fast as an internal SSD. So you're taking a speed hit there, too. And it would be kind of wasteful to buy an iMac, but always boot from some other thing. And, you know, so it's, you could do it today, but it's a compromise. But I think that is one of the dreams. Obviously, the better version of that is I don't carry anything with me and all my stuff is in the cloud. But the realities of data transfer rates and waiting for things to sync and the reliability of that and the fact that it's not really done system-wide in anything except for Chrome OS means that we're still a little bit away, farther away from that dream. I think that dream is closer than the crazy modular computer made of building blocks that you snap together. But you know, that, it may come to pass eventually, and then we will finally be freed from these form factor and state decisions that haunt us so.
All right, so let's start with some follow-up. So friend of the show, Ricky Mondello, had written in with regard to what Marco was talking about last episode with regard to Overcast and sign-in and things like that. So they had some tips with regard to what to do or some thoughts or suggestions. So Marco, can you recap that for me, please?
Yeah. So they pointed out what John had said last episode that he suspected was the case. Ricky clarified that, yes, by default, sign-in with Apple does not give name and email info. Apps have to explicitly opt in. I think the direction I'm going to go is what John recommended towards the end when I said he was frustratingly correct, of basically use the current key value store that I'm using. I'm basically going to make it support multiple entries that point to multiple anonymous accounts on Overcast. Synced with any Apple ID could then become multiple and any number of anonymous Overcast accounts, and then you would just be prompted with them at the login screen and you could pick which one. And maybe I can show you, like, this is from the device called Marco's iPhone that has, you know, these three podcasts as the top podcast editors, you know, somehow make it easy for you to detect which one is the right one, maybe like a last logged in date or something like that. Maybe I could use sign in with Apple just on the web and have it associate with these things. I have no idea, but I have a lot of options here, and so I still haven't had time to actually explore these options this summer. I've been doing a lot of other stuff, server stuff, technical debt stuff, moving my entire life to the beach, etc. But I'm working on it.
Fair enough. All right. And then Hashir Rashad writes, in Catalina, Grapher is gone along with dashboard. Sorry, John. I blame you guys for reminding Apple of Grapher. Remote disk and chess are still there. And somebody who is not supposed to do homework actually did some very helpful homework, so thank you, John.
Well, Hashir provided the timestamp link of our previous discussion of this. Well, first of all, he's wrong. Grapher is actually still there, so so much for that. But anyway, it was worth revisiting. It was back in episode 287, Open Face Compliment Sandwich, where someone asked in an Ask ATP question, it was like, which one of these two things do you think will be removed first? And so we had a couple of pairings here. And the first one was, which one will go first, dashboard or remote disk? And Casey and I said dashboard, and Marco said remote disk, and it turns out dashboard is gone in Catalina, so we were right. But then the reason I did this is because I thought Grapher was gone too, but I'm like, you know what? Let me double check this. Let me actually look in Catalina. And sure enough, Grapher is still there. So we have no decision on chess versus Grapher, and we have no decision on DVD player versus OpenGL, because DVD player and OpenGL and chess and Grapher are all in Catalina, but we will keep you posted as new versions come out.
We are sponsored this week by Hover. Visit hover.com/ATP to learn more and get 10% off your first purchase. Hover is a great place to buy and manage domain names. Now, these days, who doesn't need a domain name? It feels like pretty much everybody has them, so it's important that you have one and that yours stands out. Hover lets you do this with over 400 domain extensions to choose from to help you brand yourself online and stake out your own claim for your own place online. So recently, they've been doing this great promotion on .me. So .me is a unique extension to use, especially for a portfolio site, to showcase who you are and what you do and what you're about. So if you have a portfolio website ready to launch, go to Hover and get the .me extension for your domain. And if you don't want .me, they have over 400 names to choose from classics like .com to all new kind of fun, crazy ones like .plumbing, .diamonds. And they offer this all to you with no shady upsells, no tricks to get more money out of you, to trick you into agreeing to something you didn't want to agree to. They give you free privacy on your whois information, unlike a lot of places that charge extra for it. and it's super easy to use Hover as well. They have this great feature called Hover Connect, lets you easily set up popular web hosts with just a few clicks. And of course, if you need full advanced DNS control, they offer that as well. If you run into any problems, they have the best customer support I've ever dealt with in this industry. It's amazing. I manage most of my domains now at Hover, and it's super easy. There's a reason I do it. It's nice and easy to use. They make it easy to buy them, easy to manage them. I've never needed their support for much of anything, but the very handful of times I have, they've been wonderful. So it's great. Visit hover.com/ATP to learn more and get 10% off your first purchase. Once again, hover.com/ATP for 10% off your first purchase. Hover. Get a domain name for whatever you're passionate about.
All right, Marco, tell me, you have some new toys other than your hand truck that you have been able to play with. So what's going on there?
I've been going through kind of like the most boring midlife crisis ever, like a midlife self-improvement phase, basically, trying to improve limitations and things about myself that I wasn't happy with. I've been exercising more, dieting better. I learned to swim last month for the first time ever, and that was a big thing.
You're preparing for the ocean, that's right.
Yep. I taught myself to like seafood.
Oh, whoa, slow down. Tell me more.
That was last summer we talked about this, Casey. Pay attention.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I started it last summer. I've been working on it throughout the winter also. Like, I added sushi to my palate, and I still don't like all seafood, but I'm working on more this summer because I'm in a place that has a lot of it, so getting there. Because, like, I didn't want there to be anything that I just blanketly didn't like.
Except for Windows.
Well, yeah, you got to have standards, but like, you know, but it's limiting to not like things. It's limiting to say like, oh, I can't go to the sushi restaurant with you because I don't like anything there. Like, you know, that kind of thing. So I guess I wanted to get rid of as many limitations on myself as I possibly could. And so, damn it, I wanted to teach myself to be able to use AirPods. AirPods have never fit my ears right.
This is going to be a story like the binding of your feet. You're going to be like shaping your body with these series of increasingly large AirPod-shaped wedges.
So
Go ahead.
So, all right. So AirPods have two problems for me. Number one, they fall out easily. Like, not immediately, but if I go on a dog walk with AirPods, within about 10 minutes, if I haven't pushed them back in, they'll fall. Like, at least one of them will fall out. And the second problem is that when they are in, they were painful after a pretty short time. Like, they would just hurt my ears. But AirPods are so damn convenient. You can keep headphones in your pocket all the time.
Yep.
Now, I have never had this luxury because I couldn't wear AirPods. I also couldn't wear any of the earbuds that came before them. So I've always wanted that, to have headphones I could keep in my pocket all the time. There's also the benefits of the W1 and the H1, all, you know, the Apple Bluetooth pairing stuff. These benefits are huge when you have multiple devices. Like, right now, every time like I go on a plane, I feel like a fool because I have my big Sony headphones that are Bluetooth that are nice, but as most Bluetooth devices, like, I know there are some that compare to two or three things, but they're pretty rare. The more common case is most Bluetooth headphones, they can only be paired to one source device at a time. And so if you are, say, wanting to switch from your iPhone to your iPad on a plane, or like your phone to your laptop, you have to repair the Bluetooth headphones to the other device, which sucks. And, you know, it's
like an animal.
It's time consuming and annoying, and it sucks. And so that's no good. AirPods can easily switch between multiple devices. And so even though it isn't always a perfect process, I know, occasionally it does the wrong thing, but it's way, way better than having to repair every time. Like, repairing is so annoying that when I'm on a plane, I keep my Bluetooth headphones just paired to my phone. And when I want to use my laptop or my iPad, I get out the wire and I plug in the wire to the headphones and plug the wire into the other device, because that's less inconvenient than repairing it both ways. So anyway, going from regular Bluetooth to AirPods is as big of a jump in convenience as it was going from wired to Bluetooth in the first place. Like, it's that much of a change to have that multi-device pairing. So I really wanted to be able to use AirPods for all these reasons. You know, the convenience, the pocketability, the multi-pairing. But my ears seemed like physically incompatible. So as part of the self-improvement kick, I figured I'm going to make myself able to wear AirPods, damn it. So I started just wearing them a little bit every day. I figured, like, I can train my ears to tolerate them physically.
Oh, my word.
You put tiny bits of sandpaper on the thing and just wiggle it around there. I'm going to make these ears the right shape if it kills me.
And so I just started wearing them a little bit every day, thinking, you know, maybe I could just get my ears accustomed to them.
But before you embarked on this, did you have a consultation with someone who can see into your ears to say, like, what is it about the AirPods that is it a contact point? Which dimension is too small? Which dimension is too large? Because there may have been something you could do if you figured out the answer to that question, like, what precisely is it that is different about my ear shape that makes AirPods fall out and be uncomfortable after a period of time? Obviously, if it's something that's too tight, there's maybe not a lot you can do, but maybe there's an alternate position that you could put them in where you could add material, like add some like putty or whatever to the AirPod and put it in a different arrangement so that it stays. Like, I feel like you're doing the sort of the blind technique of like, I can't see into my ears. I know they don't work, but I'm just going to try acclimation. I'm just going to stick them in and just like eventually maybe I'll get used to it or maybe it'll stretch out or maybe or whatever. But I feel like you could have taken a more scientific approach to this and had someone examine your AirPod fit and come up with a strategy for correcting for it. That didn't happen, I guess.
I think if I would have gone to like an ear doctor or an audiologist,
I met your wife.
Oh,
I didn't mean going to a doctor.
I was gonna say like I would think I would be laughed out of any doctor's office if I actually would have gone and be like, can you help me work better with AirPods?
No, I just met another person who can see into your ear. Your wife is the obvious example.
Oh, you know, I didn't think about it, asking somebody else, but
don't you ask her to get your ear hairs? Maybe you're not at that stage of your midlife crisis yet, but you
no,
will.
Sorry,
you will be.
good to know what I have to look forward to. Mm-hmm. So my approach was simply brute force, like blindly poking, like just try to get AirPods to fit in my ears by just enduring some discomfort every day for a while, which is honestly is how I started liking seafood.
So, ringing endorsement of seafood.
Yeah, right.
The mucus of the sea, they call it.
Oh my God.
All right. So anyway, so this process of just wearing them a little bit every day actually did improve things. It actually did kind of work, and it worked enough that I can now actually wear them kind of, but it still hurt a little and they still fell out regularly if I wasn't, you know, constantly pushing them back in like every minute or so out of a walk. Now, people have recommended various add-on things to AirPods ever since I started complaining about this, like, you know, a year ago, whatever. But almost all add-on things to AirPods are like hooks to help like hook them into your ears so they're supported better, or they're like these big like rubber like tips that you can stick on them that protrude out a lot. And all these things have the same universal problem that make the AirPods no longer fit in the charging case. And to me, that's a fatal deal killer right there, because it seems ridiculous to actually use AirPods in real life if you have to constantly keep pulling off these like attachments you have on them and put them back on every time you want to use them just to get them in and out of the case. Because like you have to have the AirPods in the case all the time because you have to put them into charge if their battery life sucks. And if they aren't in the case, they're on. And so it's like they're ready to like steal the output at any moment and interpret gestures in your pocket and everything. So like you kind of have to have them in the case a lot. So I don't know why any product could possibly exist that can modify AirPods in such a way that they don't fit in the case anymore and have absolutely anybody want to use that. Fortunately, I did find one product, and I think there's a couple of clones, but they all seem to be the same thing. There's one product that does allow you to keep using the case, but is one of those like silicone add-on wrapping pads around the AirPods. In typical Amazon style, it is called Fit in the Case AirPods EarPods Covers, compatible with AirPods 2 and 1 anti-slip silicone soft sports covers accessories, Apple AirPods Earbud 2 pairs white.
This product name is very close to being a valid shell command line. Like, I looked at it briefly and it's like, you know, 2% greater than 1 for input redirection. It's got the curly, like, who puts curly braces. Fit in the case. It's not fits in the case. It's fit in the case. Capital T, the case, in curly braces. These have to be generated by a computer. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. So I found these and they were like $11 and I figured I'll give it a shot. They actually do work. They really are thin enough to just barely have the AirPods still fit in the case. They don't actually change things that much because they're very thin rubber, like, or silicone, and they're hilariously difficult to install too, like, because it, like the first time I tried to install one, I tore it in half immediately. The good thing is they actually give you an extra one. So that happens a lot. So that was, I'm like, oh, that was nice.
For a mere $11, you get an extra 0.001 cent of silicone.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. Like it was worth it. So anyway,
Did you get colors?
No, I stuck with white. All right. But although colors might be useful, like if you have like, you know, multiple AirPods in your house, you want to distinguish them, or if you want to be able to easily tell when you have these on the AirPods. But so they don't do much. They make the AirPods just a little bit bigger and just a little bit softer. And that is just enough to make the AirPods not fall out of my ears anymore. And it makes it a little bit more comfortable too. So now I can actually use AirPods. I can actually carry them in my pocket, in the case, whenever I think I might want headphones, and I can actually use them acceptably. So I have actually pretty much solved my AirPods problem. I still wish they were more comfortable, but I think these are about as comfortable as they're going to get for me. I'm actually very satisfied with that. But because they are still not amazingly comfortable, and I take a lot of long walks with headphones, so I also wanted to try the new Powerbeats Pro. This is a product that was harder to get than the original Apple Watch. Like, the Powerbeats Pro officially launched in, I think, mid-May, but they were backordered like crazy. Typical, like, Apple, you know, like, a short supply launch. Like, they were backordered for weeks, and I had to, like, keep checking the store. I refreshed the page every morning and like, you know, trying to get in. I finally snagged a pair on the morning that I was about to leave for WWDC. I was literally going to the airport in like 2 hours, and I caught it in stock at my local store, and I went over there and picked them up. So I've been using the Powerbeats Pro for a few weeks now, I guess, whatever it's been. I gotta say, they're really interesting. So these are the things that are basically AirPods, but for like more active workouts. So they are physically larger, and they have the big like hook around things that hook on top of your ears. And then they have the little rubber things that like stick then into your ears from them. So they're kind of suspended on your ear and they stick directly in instead of the AirPods. They're all kind of like resting there in your ears. So they're much better if you are doing like a super active kind of workout where AirPods might fall out of your ears if you wore them. But these are better, and also these are, I think, more water resistant and everything. But otherwise, they're basically AirPod 2s. They have the H1 chip, they have the Hey Dingus support. It takes a good few days, at least, to figure out how to get them into your ears or how to get them back into the case without an embarrassing degree of fumbling around.
Oh my goodness.
Because you gotta like to get them into your ear, you have to kind of like hook it over your ear, like twist it in, like you're like screwing it into your ear, like to get the hooked right. It's really weird. And then getting it back into the case is similarly like incredibly awkward, because you have to figure out like, wait, how does this fit? And if you get the left and the right mixed up, you're totally screwed. Like, you'll never figure that out. It's hilarious. The controls on them are a mixed bag compared to AirPods or other Bluetooth headphones. Each of the two earpieces has a volume rocker switch, like volume up and down, and a center button that functions just like the old wired clickers did. One tap on the center button is play pause, two taps to seek forward, three taps to seek back, just like the old remotes. And I think it's actually really nice to have actual buttons on these again. You know, I'm a fan of buttons, obviously. So they're tactile, they are pretty reliable. The only problem I've had with the buttons is that the double and triple click seek gestures are actually still as tricky as they've always been. Like, sometimes I double click too fast and it treats it as a pause, so I have to like deliberately like remember to wait a second between the two clicks so it really recognizes that it's two. And similarly, getting three clicks recognized to be seek back is not easy, because it often interprets it as two, which is seek forward, which is the opposite of what you want. So like it's tricky to do the seek gestures, but they do work. And those are things that AirPods just can't do at all, unless you map the things differently and everything. With these, you can't remap the controls on the Powerbeats. They're not customizable the way the AirPod, double tap gestures are. The buttons all do the same thing, always, all the time, and both earpieces buttons do the same thing. So you can't make, like, you know, the right one skip forward, the left one skip back, or anything like that. You can use Siri, of course. I found that to be, you know, the Hey Dingus support is just as reliable on this as it is on the AirPod 2s. Another downside of the controls here is that the center button that does like the play, pause, and seek is directly behind the main driver and like the rubber tip protrusion. So when you push it, you are pushing the rubber tip into your ear more. And so you're kind of like squishing it into your ear with every push. And that's not pleasant. Although I will say it is less unpleasant than the than tapping AirPods that are in your ear, which I find significantly unpleasant. So the controls are, you know, they're a mixed bag, but overall I find them significantly better than the AirPods in that way. The case that they go in is comically large if you're accustomed to AirPods. It's far too large to be pocketable in pretty much anything except maybe the largest of like winter jackets. And because of the physical controls, you can't just keep them loose in your pocket when you're not wearing them because the play pause button gets accidentally pressed all the time in pockets. So if you have them with you, like with AirPods, if you have AirPods with you and you want to like, you know, go into a store and not be so rude as to be wearing headphones in a store, or you, somebody comes up, you want to talk to them, or you arrive where you're going and you just want to take your headphones out, with AirPods, you probably have the case in your pocket. So you can just take out the AirPods and put them in the case. But with the Power Beats Pro, the case is too big to be in your pocket, so you probably don't have it with you a lot of the time that you're using them. But because the button on them gets pushed in your pocket accidentally, you also can't put them in your pocket really well either. So you have to like just kind of hold them or leave them in your ear and just hope nobody cares or whatever. So like that's a bit of an inconvenience.
Speaking of that, did you have with your AirPods yet the sort of typical most awful social experience with them, which is you're wearing them, like you said, and maybe someone comes up to you, you're walking your dog, you're taking a long walk, someone comes up to you and wants to say something or like wants to tell you that you dropped something. Whatever, someone tries to talk to you, but you're listening to something. So they get your attention, you turn to them, and you immediately tap your AirPods with your finger to stop whatever you're listening to so you can hear the person who just got your attention. And this gesture, I think I've described this on the show before, and this gesture is interpreted as you pointing to your headphones going, person, can't you see that I'm listening to something on my headphones?
Oh, no.
Because they don't understand that tapping stops the sound. They think what you're doing is going, hello, I have things in my ear. And so they think, and they go, oh, sorry. And they start to back away. Have you had that happen yet?
Oh, no, I haven't yet. I mean, I think that's the biggest argument ever for just using the pull the AirPod out to pause feature.
Mm-hmm. Yes, pulling it out is the right move, right? But if you get used to tapping, which I'm very used to because that's what I do like in my house or whatever, it's easier to tap because then you still have both hands free or whatever. But my experience is the entire rest of the world thinks that tapping is you being the rudest person ever. And I feel so bad when it happens. Then I feel like I have to explain to them, no, this tapping them makes the sound. Oh, God, forget it. it's not the most awful thing ever. I feel like Apple should have special PSAs on television and or streaming channels or whatever people watch on YouTube, I guess, or whatever people watch these days to say, just so you know, if someone taps their ear, they're not telling you to buzz off by pointing to their expensive headphone and telling you to go away. They're stopping the sound.
Oh, man. I didn't think about that.
With Power Beats, yanking them out might be more difficult because you have to like unhook them from your ear or whatever. And I guess the button, you don't have to tap as much. That's my one question.
You just twist a little and pull it out. It's real fast.
That's my question about the button, but you already answered it. Like, how hard do you have to hit that button? Because I don't like a physical button. I wouldn't want to actually press into my ear, but I guess the squishy rubber helps.
Well, and the reality is, you don't have to push it very hard at all. It pushes very easily, which is, I think, why it gets pushed so accidentally in my pocket.
Why you can't have it loose in your pockets now.
Yeah, I frequently will accidentally push the button as I'm putting it in my ear or taking it out of my ear. Because it's that easily pressed.
That case looks like it's the size of a baseball. That can't be how big it is, though.
It's not round, but it's like a
baseball with a top and bottom cut off?
It's like if you made a pillow shape that has the approximate maximum diameter of a baseball.
Yeah, that's gigantic.
And if you look, like, it isn't that ridiculous when you see the way they're designed, because like the shape of them is such that like you kind of can't fit them in anything that was much smaller than that.
If they had made them so that the two weird shapes, if you offset them to each other, went into each other's negative space, you could have got it down smaller, but I guess that's tricky.
Yeah, maybe. And then, I mean, they're hard enough to get into this case as it is. Like, to get them into that.
It'd be like one of those tavern puzzles.
Yeah, right.
You have to fit the things together in a particular arrangement.
There's like two rings, and they look like they can't come off each other, right. But somehow you have to get this one through that one, and then it comes off. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so overall, though, where I think the Power Beats Pro are substantially better, there's a couple of advantages. Number one, battery life is way better on them than AirPods because the batteries are just much bigger. Like both the case and the batteries that are actually in the earpieces are substantially larger and longer lasting. So that's great if you ever run into battery issues with AirPods. And then comfort is significantly upgraded. Because they have those ear hooks, the ear hooks are kind of suspending them in front of your ears. And so there is the part that goes into your ear, but that's not bearing the weight of the thing. Like with AirPods, the AirPods bear the weight of the whole AirPod on like the bottom, you know, surface, whatever it is, of the inside of your ear. Whereas the Power Beats are suspending them kind of nearby in there, and so a lot of that weight is falling on the top of the ear, which I think is less sensitive to it. Because it's like, you know, if you wear glasses, like it's going the same place, basically.
I was going to say, the next old person thing you have to encounter is when you eventually get glasses. I find it very uncomfortable to have anything pressing against the stems of my glasses. So I imagine if I had these hooked over my ears, fine, all well and good, maybe. Although I find the back of my ear more sensitive than the inside for the most part. But then if I also had to have a glasses stem there, I'd be like, well, does that go on the inside of the hook or on the outside? And in both things, I think it would result in something pressing against the side of my head behind my ear. And I hate that feeling.
Yeah, honestly, I don't know how well these would play with glasses for that reason.
You'll find out.
Yeah. but yeah, so comfort-wise, the fact that they're not like having all their weight on the bottom thing on the inside of my ear is a huge improvement. You only feel the fairly light pressure of those rubber tips. And they come with four different types of rubber tips in different sizes. They have the regular, like, you know, kind of like bulbous marshmallow kind. That comes in small, medium, and large, and all that's come with it. And they also have another one that's like, it's like the kind that looks like two scoops of ice cream. You know, like, it's like two half circles stacked.
Yeah, like it's like the barbed one.
Yeah.
It goes
yeah.
in, but it doesn't come back out.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
I don't know what that one's for. I tried it, and it was like too skinny, and it wouldn't seal for me. So I've been using the larges and the mediums, and they are great. And so because you have this customizability of those various tips, and they're being set there with less pressure to begin with because of the hook setup, comfort is way better. I can wear these things for a long time and feel no pain whatsoever. And the sound quality is also... So sound quality normally, it's pretty much exactly like the AirPod 2 or the AirPod 1. It's like it's the same thing as the AirPods, really, which means that when you have like a loose seal, you don't really get much bass or anything. It's fine for like podcasts, but if you get a good seal with AirPods, if they really like seal well into your ear, if you like push them in a little bit, it actually gets pretty decent even for music. With Power Beats, that's actually easier to achieve because it's much easier to get a good seal because of the way they're held there and because you have the different size tips to choose from. So I actually really like them. They are significantly less convenient than the AirPods in the sense that like they are, you know, not really pocketable, and the case is so clumsy and everything, but the convenience is really nice. Now, that being said, they still are not suitable for use on a plane. Like, they still don't seal well enough to make them particularly audible in a very loud place like a plane. You know, AirPods have the same problem, even slightly worse. And this is why, like, I am so looking forward to if Apple ever makes the rumored over-ear headphones using the, you know, W1 or H1 style pairing and chip and everything. Even if they are terrible sounding and even if they have terrible noise cancellation, I will buy those because, A, I don't use noise cancellation on planes. I just use whatever passive isolation my headphones have. I turn off the noise cancellation because I don't like it. So, like, the actual, like, active noise cancellation, I couldn't care less. Like, I just want big, comfortable over-ear headphones that passively isolate sound well. And to be able to switch those between my phone, my iPad, and my computer easily on a plane would completely negate any possible advantage that Sony or Bose could come up with their headphones. So I'm very much looking forward to if that rumor ends up being true and they end up coming out with over-ear headphones. Man, I can't wait. Whatever we call them, like head pods or airheads or whatever. Like, they, yeah, I can't wait.
So how long can you reasonably have AirPods with these little sheaths in your ears? Like, are we talking half an hour, 2 hours?
I could like walk to the store and back, or take like a short dog walk and be okay. I'd rather not. Like, I'd rather use the Powerbeats Pro or my Aftershocks or, you know, other like, you know, good portable headphones. I'd rather use those. But the AirPods are now usable. So like before, like suppose like one thing that's happened a lot is like, you know, I'll walk into town at the beach, like with the family, and then I will want to walk home, or I'll be asked to walk somewhere else to go get something, and the family will stay back, or they'll go to a playground and I need to go to the store. So I'll like split off from the family. Mm-hmm. And now I'm just alone and I'm bored. And like I have a long walk ahead of me. So it's like, if I have AirPods in my pocket, like I didn't have to plan for that. I just can always carry them, and now I have them and they're great. Yep. Right. Or, you know, something like if I'm like going to the city for the day, I can just have them in my pocket, and I might need them and I might not, and it's fine. I don't have to think about it. Like, I can't fit my Aftershocks in my pants pocket. I can fit my AirPods though. Like I can just have them there. It's just really nice. So it's like, even though they are not my favorite headphones, they're not the most comfortable headphones on me, there are cases where like I'd rather have headphones than not have headphones, even if they're a little uncomfortable after a while. And it's way better than the way they were before. Like I can actually use them and not really regret it now. So I'm pretty happy.
And then what about the Powerbeats? How long can those stay in before you get cranky or uncomfortable or whatever?
I would say they are as comfortable as the Aftershocks for me. So that would be like, you know, I can easily take a 2 hour walk with them and be, I might be a little hot at the end, but I'd be fine.
Since we're doing headphone reviews, I got new headphones recently too. I use them for my flight to WWDC. I got the Sony, whatever the latest Sony noise canceling thing. It's like
the WH, whatever, Mark III.
Yeah. And I'd been using the Bose noise canceling ones before. I do use the actual noise canceling. So that's what I wanted out of them. And I just listen to podcasts, so I don't really care what the sound quality is like, as long as it's okay. And the reason I was interested in replacing the Bose at all is because I find the Bose ear cups to be a little bit small for me and a little bit uncomfortable on a 6 hour flight. Like, they're okay in the beginning, but around hour 3.5, I'm like, oh, these are kind of annoying my ears. So I got the Sonys, which looked like they had bigger ear pads and ear cup things, and hopefully that would work better. And people had said that noise canceling is as good as Bose or better or whatever. So anyway, I got these. They're fancier. They have all sorts of weird features where they can like optimize their noise canceling based on the atmospheric pressure and other BS they tell you they're doing. Who knows what they're actually doing? But anyway, they have their Bluetooth instead of having a wire like my Bose ones did. They have a swipey touchpad thing on the outside of the ear cup, which is terrible because it's like the Apple TV remote. Is this a horizontal swipe? Is it a vertical swipe? Did I get it right? Like, am I oriented correctly? Tapping them is the worst. Oh, God, because they have a tap control. As bad as it is to tap an AirPod, imagine tapping the rigid outside of a giant cup that's like sealed to the side of your head. It's like the loudest sound ever. I'm trying to tap gently, but it's very uncomfortable. Not uncomfortable physically from like the pressure, but uncomfortable noise-wise. It is very bad. But setting that aside, I mean, you can always stop in a million other ways. You can use your phone to stop, or, you know, you could use one of those little Bluetooth controller things. You know, anyway, all that aside, the ear cups were more comfortable. What surprised me, and the thing that was annoying me by like hour two, was the band that goes over the top of my head was just like, it's like that feeling that Casey might be familiar with, and Marco maybe not as much for multiple reasons. When your hair hits the headliner in a car, right? Do you know that feeling, Gazy?
I know of what you speak, but I am not quite tall enough to have ever really had that problem, despite my hair also adding an inch or two to my height. But
if you are a taller person, or you have a car with a very low ceiling, and like your car has like a, you know, typical cheap car, you know, sort of fuzzy Muppet felt stuff on the roof. if your hair just hits that, you're like, well, so what? Your hair is barely swiping a fuzzy Muppet felt. How can that, how do you even notice that, right? But it's a strange thing. I'm sure there's some word for it, or someone did their PhD thesis on it, like that it sort of grips your hair a little bit. Like, it's not like it's like, you know, vinyl or something slippery. So the fuzzy Muppet felt grips your hair a little bit. And just through like the regular motion of your head of just like driving or whatever, your head moves and the hair kind of stays where it's being gripped, and it just ends up like moving your hair follicles back and forth and back and forth, and it becomes incredibly irritating. It's like a kind of like water torture where they drop a drop of water on your forehead. It's like, who cares, drop of water, that doesn't hurt, but by the 10,000th drop it feels like a hammer falling and you're ready to go insane. Well, this felt like the same thing, where it's just like the band was just, I don't know what it was doing. Was it moving my hair around? Was it like, it didn't feel like it had much more pressure on top of my head. It's so weird. Like, the headphones I'm wearing now that I wear every time when I podcast don't have the sensation at all. Like, they're touching the top of my head, right? But they don't feel like they're irritating the hair. The Sony ones are padded up there. It's the same, feels like the same kind of slippery, fake vinyl-y material up there. I have no idea what it is. I'm thinking maybe it's because of, like, the shape of the band. Because sometimes they make it like out of, it's supposed to look like a nice rigid U shape, but really to get it to fit over your head, you have to adjust the things. And now the nice rigid U becomes like a rigid section. And then this other section that's at a different angle than the rigid section on top. And then another little section and then the final rigid section. And maybe that makes an arc that's actually pressing on my head more. I don't know. But that band was, God, it was making me think about returning them. I kept adjusting it. Like, if I make it super loose, if I make it so the top doesn't even touch my head, but that doesn't quite work because you do need something up there for support, because they can't just stick to your ears from the pressure. Anyway, it didn't quite agree with my head. I'm trying to work out what I'm going to do about that. But overall, the ear cup comfort was way better. And the final thing, the noise canceling, I think it was better than the Bose, but the noise canceling had this weird thing. During takeoff, when the engines are ramping up, the noise canceling decided to send out some of these like terrible echolocation bursts of noise into my ears.
What? Which
it was like, Just during takeoff, when like the noise levels were changing a lot, I'm like, is that a bug? Is that a feature? Whatever it was uncomfortable, and it only happened during takeoff, but it happened during both takeoffs. So I don't know what the deal with that is, but that was kind of uncomfortable. But for the rest of the time, sound was fine. Noise canceling was even better than the Bose. Ear cup comfort was better. I have problems with the headband.
Wow. Yeah, because I use the previous version of that, the W whatever Mark II, and there aren't many differences between the two. Like, they're almost identical, and so I'm actually kind of surprised. I haven't had those issues with the fit with the headband. I mean, maybe it's just I have a different hairstyle.
it's different head size. Like, you should look at how much of the part that you expose when you adjust it. How much do you have exposed? Maybe you have much more or much less than I do, and maybe the irritability of the hairs on top of my head are different than yours.
Maybe you need a thin silicone wrap around it.
I was thinking during the flight, I'm like, what could I put up there? If I put, is it too slippery or not slippery? Like, if I put a piece of felt between the headphones and my head, or if I like coated the band at the top of my head, would I want to make it slipperier or grippier? Do I need an extra piece of padding? Again, it's plenty padded up there. It's not like it's a hard piece of plastic against my head. It's mysterious. And the reason it reminded me of the car headliner thing, because it's the type of thing, it's like, how can that even bother you? Like, it's like a pillow on top of your head with no weight on it. How is that bothering you? And yet, just the tiny motions, like your hair hitting the headliner over the course of many hours, eventually feels like the worst thing in the world. It's like a pebble in your shoe. Another example. Tiny little rock, you're walking, and like you're building up the size of this thing in your mind, so you finally take off your shoe and you look at it, and it's like the size of like a grain of sand. You're like, how did that feel so big in my shoe? It's that type of situation.
Well, I am glad, Marco, that you can feasibly carry your AirPods with you always, and that sounds sarcastic, but actually that has changed my life. Is a bit dramatic, but it has definitely improved my life to always have headphones in my little change pocket in my jeans, pretty much all the time. And you'd be surprised how often, like you were saying, you peel away from the family or something like that for a perfectly legitimate reason, and then you think, well, I could catch up on podcasts right now, or I could listen to music right now, or whatever the case may be.
Exactly. So,
I cannot overstate how much I love my AirPods, and I genuinely think they're the best Apple product of the last 5 to 10 years by a comfortable margin, in my personal opinion.
Like the Mandelbrot set, it changed the world in a tiny way. I was so sick of catching my headphone cords on things. So sick of that. AirPods just rescued me from that life. Rescued me from the life of untangling the cords, and it rescued me from the life of them getting caught on things and being yanked out of my ears. Love it. Can never go back.
We are sponsored this week by Fracture, who prints your photos in vivid color directly onto glass. Visit fractureme.com/ATP for a special discount on your first Fracture order. Now, almost all of us take and share photos. but very few of those photos ever leave our phones or our social feeds. Very few actually get printed as physical objects, and even fewer end up on display anywhere to actually be enjoyed for more than like the 2 seconds in your social feed. Fracture helps you focus on the moments that mean the most in your life by turning your favorite memories into meaningful photos that are actually printed in the physical world and hung up for you to enjoy. And Fracture prints are amazing. They're made by printing directly onto glass. It goes edge to edge. There's no border. You don't need to put them in a frame. They are their own total, complete object, and they come ready to display right out of the box. They even include the wall hanger for you right in the box. And it's a very nice, thin, lightweight glass, too. So you don't have to worry about like whether a big one will like pull out of your wall and fall off and break. Like it isn't like that at all. They're very nice, big, lightweight things. They are awesome. They also make amazing gifts. So we have them all over our house, and people compliment them all the time. But we also give them as gifts a lot. It's a great idea, like for relatives, you know, send them a picture of your kid or your dog or something, or send pictures to friends of a time you had together, like maybe on a vacation or something. It's a great idea for gifts for all occasions, and we've had tons of wonderful reactions to these when we give them as gifts. So these are awesome prints from Fracture, and you can feel good about them. They are handmade by real human beings in Gainesville, Florida, from U.S. source materials, and their factory is carbon neutral. You can see for yourself how awesome these are at fractureme.com/ATP, and you will get a special discount on your first Fracture order. They will ask you where you came from. Make sure to tell them you came from ATP. So once again, go to fractureme.com/ATP for a special discount on your first Fracture order, and make sure that you tell them you came from ATP. Thank you so much to Fracture for sponsoring our show.
We have heard many reports of a new 16-inch MacBook Pro that is supposedly coming. And there's a report at 9to5 Mac from a couple of days ago saying, yeah, this is a thing. And there are a couple of specific tidbits, including a report of a 3072 by 1920 resolution. Marco, how excited are you?
I am not excited about that screen resolution. I'm very excited about everything else. Like, everything fair else enough, about this, enough. Like, you know, the rumors have been pretty strong on this one from multiple different sources over the last couple of months that it really does seem like, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire thing, like, there is very likely to be a redesigned MacBook Pro for the first time since 2016 coming out sometime between this fall and next spring. The last redesign, the 2016 one, as you know, I'm not really a big fan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the touch bar, not a fan of the butterfly keyboard. And the most recent rumors seem to indicate that the touch bar is actually staying, but we might be getting a hardware escape key next to it. More importantly, we might be getting a new keyboard that uses scissor switches with 1 millimeter of travel, which is about twice the travel of the butterfly keyboard. Overall, very similar in many ways to the most recent desktop Magic keyboards that Apple has shipped, which have been widely recognized as like pretty decent keyboards, like pretty agreeable. You know, not everyone like totally loves them, but most people are pretty big fans. No one really hates them. Like, they're fine. And that's what you need a laptop keyboard to be, and that's what we haven't had for the last few years. Like, even if they've solved the reliability problems, which I think is still too early to say, they still failed to make a keyboard last time that everyone was okay with. Now they have a chance to do that again, and the rumors all suggest that they are probably doing that. Additionally, as I mentioned, I think last week, this will be the first laptop that has most likely been designed after the formation of the Pro Workflows team. And the Pro Workflows team has produced such wonderful things as maybe the iMac Pro. I'm not sure if they were there late enough or early enough for that. But they were definitely there to influence things like the new Mac Mini and the new Mac Pro. And those are both really, really good products that did things and added things and kept things that we never would have guessed the like 2016 era Apple would have done. Things that customers wanted and needed. But like, Apple back then was in the mood of taking a lot of things away and pushing things really aggressively, quote, forward in ways that we didn't all agree were the way forward. But this is the first thing in a new series, and I cannot wait to see what it is. Good or bad, I at least just want to see movement. And I think I have faith, based on how they've done the last few new releases like this, it's probably going to be really good. Now, about that screen resolution, the one thing that's bugged me about the Retina MacBook Pro screens ever since their introduction in 2012 is that in the pre-Retina, in the last few models of the pre-Retina age, Apple increased the point density of the screens. You could see this in the original MacBook Air, which was like, I think, 1366 by 768, something like that, and the 13-inch version. And then right before they went Retina, the 15-inch could be had with a 1680 by 1050 screen, and the 17-inch could be had with a 1920, I think, yeah, 1920 by 1200 screen. The resolution, like the horizontal resolution of the 15-inch was 1680 points across. When they went Retina in 2012, the effective, like, you know, the number of pixels went up because it went Retina, but the effective point width went down from 1680 back down to 1440, where it was like a few years earlier in the regular, you know, non-Retina lineup. And as the rest of the lineup went Retina, that same step back happened. It happened on the 13-inch. It eventually happened even to the Air when that went Retina. That didn't happen on the desktops, mind you. When the iMac 5K came out and later the iMac 4K, that same step back did not happen. They went exactly double the number of points they were pre-Retina. So we know that it's possible not to do that on the desktop, and they didn't. On the laptops, they made that step backwards. At the time, like, you know, 2012 was 3 years before, or 2 years before it ever came to the desktop. Years before it came to the desktop. And so, you know, it kind of made sense back then, like, well, you know, it's still really new technology. Maybe there are concerns about economics of the screen panels or quality of the colors or battery concerns of having more pixels to drive or whatever else.
Yeah, battery concerns is what Apple cited, by the way, that when we asked that question at the introduction of the Retina, it was like, well, there's just so many more transistors. Battery is why we did this. And everyone basically accepted it.
Right. And they introduced these scaling modes at the same time where you could, for the first time ever in their laptops, you could simulate higher resolutions than what the panel actually supported using these new GPU accelerated scaling modes that it would basically render the image to a, I think, like a 4x or 3x buffer. Like, it rendered it to a higher buffer and then scaled it back to the physical pixels of the screen. It's the same technique that was used later in the iPhone 6 Plus and the 6, 7, and 8 Plus all used it until we finally got true 3x in the iPhone 10 series. But anyway, they did this pixel scaling mode where, like, it would, the native pixel resolution for the 15-inch was indeed stepped back to the 1440 points at 2x density, but you could set it to the way the old ones used to look at 1680, and it would just kind of, like, blur the pixels to look to fit the panels, you know, to make it look kind of like that. But it never looked as good as when you were running it in the true native 2x format. Like, they never had it exactly as sharp and as nice looking as when you were running it at 1440 at the native 2x scale. When the 2016 era models came out, starting with actually the 2015 MacBook One, like with the MacBook One, and then following into 2016 the touch bar generation of MacBook Pros and later the MacBook Air, they actually set the one step up scaling mode as the default screen resolution, the way they shipped. So by default, since 2016, and for every 12-inch MacBook, they have shipped in a mode where the screen is a little bit blurry and not as good as it could be because they just haven't put enough pixels into it to make it have true 2x Retina clarity without using blurry scaling modes at the default resolutions they've been shipping, which to me is a crime. On the 12-inch, you can kind of forgive it because regardless of what they charge for it, that's a budget machine. Like, it has budget parts. It's a low-end machine in lots of ways. So it kind of makes sense on that. It kind of makes sense on the Air because the Air is also there to hit a low price point. But on the MacBook Pro, the 13-inch and 15-inch Pro, I don't think we need to be doing that anymore. And the desktops prove that we don't have to do it. Like, the 5K iMac and later the 4K iMac proved it isn't like just like, oh, we won't notice. We can get away with it. Or nobody wants that. No, we want it, and we do notice. You know, they didn't like do the scaling mode by default on the desktops because it's better not to. So on the laptops, you know, we're sitting here and we're enduring this like 2012 era screen density all this time. In the next generation, surely it's time now. Surely now, whatever factors are at play, we can afford to step up the pixels by whatever it would be, like 20% in each dimension. It isn't even, it's not like we're doubling it again. Like it's, you know, adding like 20% in each dimension or something like that. Surely we can do that now. And the cost is able to be spent on that now in both battery and economics of the panels. Surely. The only thing I don't like about this new rumor is that it quotes the screen resolution in a way that that almost certainly suggests that they haven't done this, that they're sticking with the same thing of just scaling all the time by default and just accepting that the panel is just going to be blurry. And I'm not okay with that. Like, after all this time, I mean, yeah, I'm going to buy this thing anyway because I just can't wait to get a new keyboard. But that was like one little nitpick that I've had since 2012 that I thought they would have solved by now. And they put so much effort and marketing and promotion into having these really awesome screens in these other ways, like in color and contrast and HDR and color profiles and wide gamut and all that. Like, they do all this amazing stuff with the screen, but now they're just a little bit blurry all the time because we can't have all the pixels that they actually are kind of BS-y claiming that they have by having that be the default mode. Like, that's not okay. And they can do better than that, and they should do better than that.
So I think the iMac is not... I mean, the iMac is a different scenario because you don't have battery power and you have more depth. So I'm not sure. If you were to ask Apple, I bet their answer would still be the same as it was in 2013, which is, in a very, very thin screen like this with battery constraints, if we put all those transistors behind there for the actual 2x scaling of the resolution you want, it would hurt us in battery life. And of course, our answer would be make the damn thing 1 millimeter thicker and be quiet. But, you know, Apple. When I saw this rumor, I was at least glad that it wasn't going to be 1440 by 900 points, right?
Just larger.
Yeah, it is a larger physical screen. And it has more pixels than the smaller one, which made me hope that if I was ever forced to use one of these for work, which is the only way I would probably ever have one of these, that I would be able to put it at native 2x and not feel like I don't have enough room. Obviously, this at 2x, it would not be the same as the resolution you wanted, you know, 1680 by 1050 points, right? It's not quite the same, but it's better than the current 15-inch if you put it at native 2x. And so I'm hoping that if I go into the store and set this one to native 2X and I look at it and go like, yeah, I think I could live with that. It's reasonable. Especially as I get older, like the fact that everything would be slightly larger at that 2X resolution, but there would be a more screen that maybe it would be worthwhile. But I agree. I think the fact that there hasn't been an Apple laptop with when the LCD is running at native res, has a point resolution that matches the previous 15-inch, let alone the 17-inch. 17-inch, by the way, was 1920 by 1200 native pixels. There hasn't been a display with that number of points, point dimensions at native res since 2013. And that's not a good streak. And I power is honestly the only thing I can think of, because we know they can make a display like this, and I imagine they can make it just as thin. It's just a question of how much more battery power would take, and people would pay. I mean, maybe does this mean they need to bring back the 17-inch, right? And then maybe they'll feel okay about making that one thicker, or maybe they won't have to make it thicker because it'll have more, you know, just have more surface area to put battery in. I don't know, but I think it's another gap in their lineup, and hopefully they'll fill it somehow.
Well, and it seems too like this could be a nice differentiator for the Pro line. Like and you would think the Pro workflow team would bring this up at some point. Like, yeah, you know what the fact is? Like, these screens being scaled does kind of suck. Also, like, the scaling is not free. The scaling has a computational cost on the GPU to achieve. And so, like, at some point, surely, like, the cost of driving the more pixels has to, like, you know, outweigh that, right? I don't know.
It's much cheaper to do that computation in some dedicated hardware on the GPU and some little dinky thing than to actually do the transition. I have to imagine that's the power thing. And honestly, I think that's their explanation would be both the power and also the idea that, yeah, it's blurrier, but like most people can't tell. Just like no one could tell that the 6 Plus was not at native res just because everything was so small. Then I imagine that the number of people who can tell the difference between the native 2X and the one step down from it is also probably very small and will eventually not include you as your eyes get worse with age. So I can kind of see where they're coming from. But to your other point, it's like, Well, then why not do that on everything? Why not make the $7,000 display non-native? Why not make the iMac 5K non-native? It's like, you don't, because it is actually better this way. So there should be one. How about there should be one model that Apple sells that, again, can match the point density at native res of the old 15-inch.
Right.
We're not even saying there has to be one model that matches the 17.
If there's any model that should do it, it should be this one. So I hope this rumor is wrong. I don't have, I mean, honestly, my confidence isn't high, because usually when Ming-Chi Kuo quotes a screen resolution, it's usually correct. So that's, I don't have high hopes here, but I really am hoping that this rumor is wrong and that they actually have increased it to be what it should be and kind of what they're selling. Like, the fact that it's the default mode surely suggests to people that this is what the screen is actually pulling off. And the fact that it's not, I find BS-y, you know, and I'm not comfortable with them selling it in scaling mode by default and saying, here, look at how great the screen is. And it's like they're intentionally hobbling it you know, just to achieve a faked increase in screen real estate, really. And I want it to be real.
I think they might sell this one at native 2X, though, because it's like, it's, you know, it's 1536 points across, which is not 1680, but like, maybe they'll actually sell it. Maybe the default will be 2X.
I mean, maybe, but that would make it look, it would make it look significantly different and less advanced than all the ones next to it in the Apple Store.
Well, it would make the screen look clearer, and it would make everything on it look bigger. And clearer and bigger is actually a selling point for a lot of customers when it comes to displays on laptops.
And that's true. Although most of those customers probably aren't buying the highest end model in the store.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, we'll see. Like, scaling modes, like, I only Apple has these stats, but I wonder how many people run their phones at like the bigger mode. You know, during setup when it asks you, do you want this to be bigger?
Yeah, the display zoom.
Like, if you ever watched anyone go through that process with no input from you and just like letting them pick what they want, they look at the two, and as far as they're concerned, they want the one where the pictures are bigger. Like the nuances of what that means, like here's one showing a bunch of apps and here's one showing a bunch of apps, but each app is bigger. It's like, oh, I want the one where they're bigger. That is their only concern. The nuances of nativeness don't factor into it, nor does the idea that if they're bigger, you can see fewer of them. Like, it's just an obvious choice. Oh, bigger. Why would anyone pick the smaller one? And so it's a different set of values leads to those decisions. So I really do wonder if native 2X, where everything's slightly bigger, would actually be seen as a benefit of the 16-inch. I mean, you know, the screen itself is bigger, and it doesn't make sense that the things on the screen are also bigger, and also it seems a little bit sharper for some reason. And so maybe that's a selling point.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what this laptop brings. Like I said earlier, I am casually in the market for a MacBook Adorable replacement, and to go all the way to a 16-inch is probably not going to be the answer, but I at least want to see what this brings, and if it's the sort of thing where this is the halo car of the MacBook Pro family and has something that I'm really interested in, say a new keyboard, which I'm not as, you know, angry about as Marco is, but still, a more reliable keyboard sounds good to me. You know, if that arrives in the 16 in the fall, then maybe I would wait until the spring to get, like, you know, what would hopefully be a new Adorable or maybe even a 13-inch MacBook Pro at that point that has, you know, the same keyboard and a similar setup. I don't know. I'm curious to see this for sure, though. And like you had said, Marco, this is something new, and new is always exciting. So I'm very curious to see it.
Speaking of Halo Car, and given our recent Mac Pro musings, this opens, remembering that the non-Retina 15-inch that Marco was talking about, that higher point, higher resolution screen was an option. It wasn't the default screen. So Apple could offer this laptop with this screen at this exact resolution and then have as an option, an upgrade option, a native 2X display with a higher point density. And that upgrade option could be $7,000. And there you go. There's your Halo Car laptop.
Yeah, the funny thing, like, the option back then, the two things about those that are interesting, the option back then was actually very inexpensive. I think it was like $150. It was very inexpensive to go from the 1440 screen to the 1680 screen, and more interestingly, the 1680 screen came in two finishes, matte or glossy.
And the finishes weren't an extra cost. The matte one didn't cost an extra $1,000? Weird.
Mm-hmm. And the total upgrade cost was like $150 or $200. It was in that ballpark. And yeah, but man, if they offered this with a higher resolution screen and a matte option, I mean, $7,000 would be excessive, but like, What do you think? What do you think would actually be a reasonable price for that? That Apple would actually also charge, like, so both reasonable and also like realistic for Apple these days. I think $400 extra.
Yeah, $500. That's what I was gonna say.
Yeah, same. I was gonna say $500.
I mean, and I'm just saying for the resolution, like for the nano texture, I would say five and up, like maybe 600.
I don't know about the nano texture. Like I feel like the nano texture is all about like people in a particular environment where they really need to see what it looks like and they want to really take down. I mean, I guess it's more important on a laptop than a desktop, but I feel like the things that motivated the weird nano texture for the Mac Pro display or the XDR or whatever, maybe aren't at play because those same people would say, well, I don't care what you do with your laptops. It's not like I'm going to use one of those to do my work on my future film or whatever, because I'll be in the studio and I'll be staring at a much larger screen. But who knows? Well, now that they have the nanotechnology, the nanotexture technology in their toolbox, maybe they'll just apply it to everything and add an astronomical markup to all of their products.
Although, on one hand, you need it for the laptop more than ever because you are in environments with varied lighting with laptops. On the other hand, I would imagine the nanotexture is going to have a problem with cleaning and fingerprints. Yeah,
if you're not supposed to touch it. I don't know the answer to that. Do any of you know? I didn't actually ask the people in the room of like, I had heard lots of people saying, oh, you're really, really not supposed to touch the nanotexture. But then I can't tell if that's just saying like, since it costs $1,000, haha, keep people's grubby fingers away from your $1,000 finish. Or if there's an actual issue in that, if you get grease in it, cleaning it is difficult because you're not supposed to like rub it or something. I have no idea what's the truth there.
It actually, they provide a cleaning cloth in the box, and it isn't $1,000. They don't provide a stand,
but everything comes with a cleaning cloth. Like my Thunderbolt display came with a cleaning cloth.
Right,
like, that's fine. I just want to know, like, if someone does touch your screen, is it any harder to clean than just a regular glass screen?
Well, you have to hold it at a 70-degree angle.
Speaking of touching laptop screens, like this, so I have the Air in the house that is technically the homework laptop. I think it's called like homework laptop or something. So the kids use it. For the most part, I'm pretty sure none of them are touching the screen, like, you know, accidentally or habitually, like because they think it's a touch screen, because they're not really habituated to use touchscreen laptops. Granted, they use their iPads all the time, but I don't think they're actually touching it like, oh, I thought I could hit the OK button, right? But the entire frame of the display is covered in fingerprints. It looks worse than any of their iPads because they, like, I don't know, they have grubby hands, and for some reason, like, well, I know my daughter picks up the laptop by the screen, which is what, how she destroyed. She picks up the screen all the time, and that's how she destroyed the 2011 laptop. Well, she destroyed the 2011 laptop by dropping it, but also by repeatedly picking it up by the screen. So the hinge became incredibly loose, but then the dropping is what eventually cracked the screen. But yeah, like a huge amount of grease. And I think about cleaning it sometimes. I'm like, why bother? Like in a week, it's going to look like that again. But now it's getting to the point where I'm like, have I waited too long? Has the screen gone over? Like, is it now impossible to remove the finger grease that has accumulated on the screen? Like, if I were to try to clean it, would I be removing like whatever sort of anti-glare finish is on the the screen? I think that the grease is now a structural element of the screen, and I can never remove it.
Oh, God.
Oh, my Lord.
We are sponsored this week by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com/ATP and enter offer code ATP at checkout to get 10% off. Make your next move with a beautiful website from Squarespace. Now, look, we are programmers, many of us who listen to the show, and we can make our own CMSs, but these days, that's a terrible use of time because two things have changed since the bad old days of the early 2000s. Websites have gotten much more complicated to make look professional, to make work professionally, and to make appear the way people want them to appear. There's so many more factors these days. People want more dynamic content, more dynamic widgets and layouts. And of course, you have to deal with responsive layout, and you have to deal with security and SSL and uptime and everything else. So it's more complicated these days than it used to be. And also, there's tools out there that make it super easy, and Squarespace is the best one of these I have seen. Squarespace makes it so easy to not deal with any of that complexity yourself and to just make a beautiful, highly functional website with almost no time and effort. that there's really no reason to build your own CMS anymore unless you need something very specialized. But for almost everybody out there, for almost every website out there, Squarespace has you covered. Their sites look professionally designed regardless of your skill level. There's no coding required. It's all managed by intuitive, easy-to-use tools with live previewing. What you see is what you get. Custom colors, custom fonts, custom layouts, whatever you want to do. So start your free trial and just see what I mean here. You'd be amazed how much you can get done on Squarespace in like 1 hour. I swear, it's that easy. Give it a try at squarespace.com/ATP. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace after that, make sure to go back there, squarespace.com/ATP, and use code ATP to get 10% off your first purchase. Once again, squarespace.com/ATP, code ATP for 10% off your first purchase. Make your next move with a beautiful website from Squarespace.
Alrighty. Jack Friedeye, I hope I have that right. Do you think Apple would or could re-implement target display mode on the iMac maybe this fall in order to make a lower-end display available for the Mac Pro? Would that be a solution for you? I mean, I guess anything is possible, but I don't personally see them coming back to target display mode possibly ever on an iMac.
Yeah, I don't think they would either for a number of reasons. I mean, so this was kind of a big deal because when the 27-inch iMac first came out, non-Retina, the regular 27-inch iMac, this was at the time when there were no 27-inch 2560 by 1440 or 1680 monitors on the market. Like, the only ones you can get that had the 2560 pixels across were the 30-inch class monitors that Apple and a few other companies like HP sold. The 27-inch iMac had that same resolution in a smaller panel. Actually, it lopped off the bottom a little bit. It went to 16:9 instead of 16:10 or whatever it is. But anyway, so like it was 2560 across by 1440, and it was an awesome panel. It was way, you know, brighter, better contrast, and whatever else than a 30-inch. And when it came out, the iMac with this panel in it cost less than the 30-inch monitor did alone. And it included this with like a quote free computer behind it, basically. So there was actually strong demand for people who wanted this kind of monitor and all these amazing specs on it. And this was before Apple sold it separately as what later became the Thunderbolt display. they had this target display mode where you could, I think, like, you know, hold down a certain key combination or something, and you could plug a computer into the iMac and just use the iMac screen as that computer's monitor. So because there was this kind of demand for this, I know I heard a few people who tried it, but it wasn't actually very good because, first of all, you know, it was kind of, you know, wasteful conceptually in the sense that, like, you were buying a computer to not use the computer part of it ever, really, and to plug some other computer into it. If you wanted to use both, like to have the iMac and maybe have a laptop, you couldn't leave the iMac booted in this mode. You'd have to, like, you know, reboot it into target display mode, I think. So it was like, that was kind of weird. And also, like, if the computer part of it broke or somehow, like, went wrong, target display mode wouldn't work either. And so you kind of had to rely on that computer working forever. And this was also before SSDs. So there was, like, a spinning hard drive back there just spinning around, doing nothing. Like, it was kind of a crappy solution. It wasn't a great way to get a 27-inch display. And it lasted until Retina came. And when Retina came, it went away. And there were lots of good reasons for that. Like there, at the time that the 5K Retina iMac launched in 2014, there was no cable standard that could drive it at full resolution. Like Thunderbolt 2, I don't think could do it. These days, a Thunderbolt 3 cable could do it. So theoretically, like the modern iMacs that have Thunderbolt 3 ports could theoretically offer this. But I think the like hardware, like wiring and support for it would be non-trivial. And I think just not a lot of people actually ended up using it because it was so clunky to actually use in practice. So while they maybe could technically do it, not only do I not think that they will, but I don't think they should. I think if they want to address the market that I hope they want to address of people who want an Apple-made external 5K display that is not $7,000, I hope they do address that market. And if they're going to address that market at all, they should do it properly by actually having a standalone 5K monitor that is like the iMac without any computer attached to it. Like, just do that again. The same way they did in the pre-Retina days with the Cinema display, like, and the Thunderbolt display. Just do the same thing again, because they're really good at that, and no one else is. And there's a huge hole in the market. Target display mode is a hack that never worked very well and shouldn't be used to solve this problem.
Yeah, the amount of money they would spend getting Target Display Mode to work, sort of doing the plumbing to get the, you know, to get a Thunderbolt, one of their Thunderbolt ports or all their Thunderbolt ports to be able to pipe directly into the display controller and all the other internal stuff they have in there would be weird and expensive and so much more difficult than just making a display. And honestly, and we talked about, we joked about this at the WWDC show, if they just charge the same price as the one that has the computer inside it, but this one doesn't have a computer, people would still pay it. It would be such so high margin, and people would be happy to pay it because you'd have the anchoring of the $7,000 XDR, making it seem like a bargain. Obviously, you price it like the low-end iMac and not like the top-end iMac Pro, but I think people would pay a surprising amount. And probably up to, honestly, probably up to half the price. So you could probably charge $3,000 for this thing, and it would be a ripoff. But people will be like, well, here are my choices. Nothing, or a $3,000 monitor, or a $7,000 monitor that has HDR and higher resolution. And the $3,000 starts to look reasonable. Or, you know, or I can find an old LG, or I can buy some weird brand that I've never heard of that supposedly has a 5K display. You know, it's the choices are slim. So if Apple wants to make money, now's the time to do it. Assuming there will be some future wave of people making 5K displays, which maybe will never come, and maybe that's why Apple feels like they don't have to do it. But if I was given the choice between you can use a 5K iMac, some new 5K iMac in Target Display Mode, or for the exact same price, you can have a 5K monitor, I would take the monitor because, for the reasons Marco said, I don't have to worry about a whole computer being back there and more things that can break, even if the price was the same. It's like, well, wouldn't you want the free computer and you can also use it as a computer? I'm like, I'm not going to use it as a computer. It's going to be attached to a desktop. It's not like every once in a while I'm going to yank it out of my desktop and use the second computer behind the monitor. I'd rather just have the monitor. So, I don't know. I don't think they're going to do Target Display Mode. Unless it's really easy. Unless it like falls out of, you know, the new arrangement of the internals of the new 5K iMac. Like, they've simplified everything because now they do have Thunderbolt 3, so they don't have to have that double bit, essentially internal double driving the display through this weird timing controller that they were bragging about that multiplexes it or whatever. You know, once that is simplified internally, if Target Display Mode just falls out of the fact of the internal architecture, sure, by all means, offer it. It's like, it's, you know, good flexibility, but it's not what I'm looking for.
You know, something that I'd forgotten about, but while you guys were talking, I'd remembered, is that you can also do Target Disk Mode, which really doesn't solve the problem we're talking about here. But one time, or maybe a couple times just for fun, I actually booted my work-issued MacBook Pro on my iMac. Or I guess, well, strictly speaking, my iMac booted itself off of my work-issued MacBook Pro's hard drive. So I was using all of my iMac's bits and bobs, except instead of using the onboard SSD, I was using the SSD in my MacBook Pro, which was very weird and very cool and definitely had some caveats and drawbacks, most especially the keychain lost its ever-loving mind because it was basically a new computer at this point. But it is something you can do, and I did a write-up about this 3 years ago on my website, which I'll link in the show notes. But just something that's a neat party trick for very, very nerdy parties, I guess.
Yeah, like Target Disk Mode has been on the Mac forever, and it's an awesome tool for migration or data recovery, like, for, you know, for that kind of thing. Like, I don't think it's intended and was ever intended to be just booted up for fun. Like, I'll just use my iMac like this. Like, I don't think it's ever meant for that. But yeah, for like transfers and recovery, it's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it was nice having my work machine on this 20, well, so to speak, on my 27-inch screen. I mean, ultimately, it was the iMac booting off of the work machine's hard drive, like I said. But, you know, it was very freeing having a 27-inch screen all of a sudden. But it was not, that juice was not worth the squeeze, ultimately.
You're bringing back the thing from the beginning of having, like, a little thing that you carry around that has your data and that you just connect it up to work. Although the thing is very large in the case of the laptop. Do you recall if when you put your laptop into Target Disk Mode, did it show the FireWire logo on the screen as, like, a screensaver?
I actually have a picture on my website, and it is, it's the little lightning bolty thing. I guess
it shows whatever the interface is that you're using. So, like, on modern ones, it'll show a Thunderbolt icon.
I thought there was some period of time where it continued to show the FireWire logo even when it wasn't using FireWire, like maybe just during the transition, but I may be wrong about that. That's why I was curious.
FireWire had a good logo. Like among like the connection standard logos that we've had over the years, I think FireWire's was the best one.
It looks a little bit like the Destiny logo.
Oh, God.
Three-pointed thing, right?
I don't even know. I can't even judge the reference because I don't even know what Destiny logo looks like.
Can't believe you don't.
Okay, let's move on.
You really can't believe that?
All those videos all the things that I'm tweeting and retweeting about Destiny, yeah, I think you would have come across it.
You don't think that I muted that 18 years ago?
Using that hashtag. Sneak past your filters.
Oh, please no. All right, Chris Hubbard writes, what software like cPanel does Marco use to manage his servers on Linode? Chris continues, I use another shared business hosting service. I had considered Linode, but the price of a cPanel solo license is more than what my entire hosting cost.
I don't use anything like that. I simply administer my servers manually using command line stuff and setup scripts that I write and things like that. There are even tools now that make it even easier. I can't really recommend any because I'm not really in that market. I've never used any of the other tools. But things like cPanel, they came up in the era of like bulk shared hosting where you didn't have VPSs or cloud instances, which are basically VPSs. You didn't have those yet. You had like dedicated servers that you could run 200 small websites on and have to like manage all these different websites off of one box. Like that's kind of where that software came up. And there's some justification for it in that kind of a situation. Although even then, I think you have probably better tools these days for even that kind of thing if you still do that. But these days when you're running your own, you know, VPSs or cloud node kind of things, like there's, I think, very little reason to use that kind of stuff. It does help if you're a novice. You know, it helps you like, you know, add domains and stuff like that if you're a novice. But honestly, it's probably easier to just learn how to do that yourself manually from the command line than it is to deal with any of these packages these days. And I'll say, and I said on Twitter too, like I kind of responded to this on Twitter as well, like so many developers or, you know, nerds or power users will jump through ridiculous hoops to avoid learning how to use the command line because they think that it's harder than it really is. The fact is, like, learning basic Unix command line stuff, things like, you know, basic directory management, file management, basic editing with a tool like Vim /vi, which is available pretty much everywhere on everything, on every server everywhere. Like, learning how to use these things at a basic level is such a critical skill for so many types of, like, advanced computer tasks and power user tasks and system administrator tasks. And it doesn't change very much over time. It hardly, like, the basics of things like using the command shell and piping commands to each other and things like that, like, that stuff hardly ever changes. You can learn it once, and it'll be pretty stable and pretty useful for your entire career in all likelihood. So it's worth learning, and it's not that hard to learn. I would say it's easier than things like Swift. Like, I think it's actually much easier to learn shell stuff than it is to learn Swift. If you are a nerd enough to want to run your own servers, you have the capacity to learn command line basics, and you really should. And there's lots of great documentation out there, much of which is published by Linode, but it works on any server. But you know, you can get a server for like $5 a month and just try, like, just try setting up a website and, you know, just stumble through with guides and stuff until you figure it out. And you will eventually build up these skills of using command line tools and editing config files and stuff like that. And these skills really last a lifetime, and they're worth learning. So I would say try not using stuff like cPanel and not using automated setup tools, and just try setting up yourself and see how far you get, because that skill is worth building.
Another thing I would add is that different people learn in different ways, and I always find this type of learning helps me, but I think particularly with the command line, because it's such a large problem domain, like, you think of it as one thing, like, I know, quote-unquote, the command line, or even worse, the terminal, right? But really, it's this entire universe of different operating systems and different shells and different pieces of software that you are manipulating from those shells on those operating systems. The number of variables is huge. So I think one good way to get started on this is to find some way to get a basic conceptual understanding of the relationship of the pieces to each other, rather than learning, I know specifically the magic things that I type to make this happen with this particular software on this platform, because then it can just become like sort of cargo culting, where it's like, well, I know this command and I know that command. And like, if you don't understand what the little, you know, greater than signs and ampersands and whatever else you're typing on the command line, or a dot slash, and like if you don't understand all that stuff, it can still seem like magic, even though you've, like, quote unquote, learned it. understanding the fundamentals. What is all this stuff? What is a terminal? What is, you know, what happens when I type a command and hit return? And how does that translate into something happening? That is conceptual. And if you learn that, then everything else is just details. It's kind of like, you know, learning the basics of programming. You learn about loops, conditionals, and stuff like that, and functions. And like with those basics, a lot of programming language, you become like, oh, just, I understand what functions are. Just tell me how functions work in this language. I understand what arrays are. Just tell me how arrays work in this language, right? And so that type of basic understanding, no, it won't make you a super duper expert, and you won't know the esoteric stuff, or esoteric stuff, as people tell me it's pronounced. But it will really help you. It will really help you not feel like you're at sea, because it's like, oh, I knew how to set up Apache, but now here's this new thing, and I don't really understand what those things I was typing for Apache to get Apache to work actually meant. So I don't have any sort of ladder to grab onto when I'm trying to set up Nginx, right? So that's my suggestion. Unfortunately, I don't have any suggestions of like, where do I go to get that conceptual understanding? But I think if you look at any piece of documentation, you can tell, is this just telling me how to set up a particular piece of software? Or is this trying to tell me, this is what a shell is, this is what Unix is, this is what files and directories are, here are some basics about it. Like, if you see something, a guide that starts with that type of information, I would dive in and make sure you get some of that before you get neck deep in setting up your MySQL server.
All right, and finally, Joseph Dykstra asks, what are your opinions on people listening to ATP faster than 1x? Some podcasters dislike their shows being sped up. As one of the people who does not edit this show, I don't personally have a problem with it. If you can and want to listen to us faster, then go for it and do what you got to do. John, as the other person who does not edit the show, do you have opinions about this?
I don't care. People listen to it however they want to listen to it. I listen to my podcast at 1x, but I understand why people don't. So, you know, I mean, the only place it impacts my life at all is people constantly telling us that we sound drunk when they hear us at 1x. But it's funny that it's always the same thing. It's always you sound drunk, not you sound tired or slow or yep, groggy. Yep. It's always drunk. So they always go right to the drinking. Anyway, other than that one effect, I don't care. Listen to whatever you want. We're just glad you listen.
Exactly. Mr. Editor, however, what are your thoughts?
Basically the same. I mean, I make a podcast app and I give people speed controls.
He's the one who makes the app that does this.
Yeah. I make the app that most of our listeners use to listen to the show in, and I give them the option, and it's totally fine. I listen faster than 1x myself to almost everything. There are very few shows I listen to at 1x. Most shows I listen to at about 1.25x.
Yep, same.
So it's not like super fast, but it's faster than normal. And there are indeed a lot of podcasters who have like almost like a moral objection, like, you know, or to similar features like smart speed of like, we put those silences in there for a reason, and if you shorten them, you're ruining our editorial choices. And like, I get why people would think that, but I don't think that. I think that we put our podcasts out there for people to listen to, and once we do that, it's in your hands. Like, a book publisher doesn't tell their readers like, you aren't allowed to skim any pages in my book. You have to read every word very carefully. You can never skim. You can never look forward. Like, that's impractical and unreasonable to expect of people. What actually happens is you put your work out there the way you intend for it to be done, but then once you put it out there, it becomes the audience's, like, to do with what they want. And they're not going to experience it the way you intend 100% of the time. And you just got to deal with that. So we put our podcast out there, and you can listen to it however you want. As John said, we're just glad that you listen. So thanks.
I feel like the point stands about, though, like the skimming type of thing. Like, I think an author would feel like, oh, I don't want people skimming my thing. And the reason I listen to everything in 1x is because I do want to hear those silences. But everyone has different priorities. If you don't have time to get through an entire episode in your commute unless you do it at a faster speed, or if you find it too boring to listen to people talk at 1x, like, those outweigh the thing of like, because you are missing some nuances of timing that, gaps in silence can be annoying and you're getting rid of the annoyance, but sometimes the gaps in silence can make a joke funnier and you're missing out on that, and it's a trade-off. But people understand what the trade-offs are, and they make the trade-off that makes sense for them. If time compression is more important than hearing the pauses in someone's speech, that's the choice they make. And same thing with skimming. I think if we did a music show, I think all of us would have a bit more of an objection, because they'd be like, but music, it's like, it's rhythmic and you're hearing it faster and it's really weird, and smart speed might do weird stuff to music. But other than just that one little song break we have, it's not a music thing. So because it's speech, I think it is less onerous. But everything you said is the reason I do listen at 1x. And the skimming thing from authors is the reason people who make content might wish you didn't listen to it sped up, because they'd feel like you're missing something that they worked hard on. Like, oh, you skimmed that page and that was actually my best passage, but you just really kind of skipped over it. But that's, you know, there's nothing you can do about that. And I bet the author would just be happy that you bought their book. And so that's where we're coming from.
Yeah. And like, and there are people who watch movies at faster than 1x. Like that's, it's this phenomenon is spreading. And, you know, we have so much media available to us in the modern world. We have such a surplus of available media. Somebody who watches movies at 2x or listens to podcasts at 2x, they don't hate movies. They don't hate podcasts.
Well, the movie people kind of hate. They kind of hate movies.
Well, maybe. Yeah, maybe. I haven't tried
it. But it's like music. Like, I feel like speech is the one where it's the most excusable. Because we're not singing and you're not listening to the melodic sound of our voices. That's not why you're listening to the show. It's not an ASMR show, right? It's transference of information and to secondarily emotion, which I think still comes through. Whereas if it was music, much less so. And I feel like movie, because there's a visual element and that gets spit up and everyone walks fast and stuff.
I mean, honestly, like, I don't want to do that to movies, but I kind of get why some people do, because it's like the same thing. And, you know, when we have this massive surplus of content available to us, like, the reason I speed up podcasts by a little bit is because I want to listen to more podcasts. And like, and I have more podcasts that I want to listen to than I have time. Sometimes if I get really behind in my queue and I have this massive queue, I'm not going to go delete things I want to listen to. I will just increase my speed for that week. And then once I run out of things, I'll slow it back down again. You know, that's a control I have. Like, and I'm doing all this so that I don't have to cut things. So I don't have to listen to fewer podcasts, and I still have room to try new podcasts. Like, that's why I do this. So I think that's the reason why most people do it. Like, most people I know who listen to podcasts faster than 1x listen to a ton of podcasts. So if their alternative is just listen to fewer, I feel like kind of everyone loses there. So yeah, people can listen to whoever they want.
A good example of sped up video is WWDC sessions. I often watch it faster than 1x, just because there's lots of pause, because they, you know, Apple trains their speakers to take their time and pause between slides, which is great and everything. But sometimes I more or less know most of the material and I just wanted to get to the good stuff. So just letting it run at 1.5x while half paying attention to it is the great way to do that. And that's visual, but it's mostly just spoken word and slides. So I don't get to see people walking across the stage really fast and making it distracting.
Right. And they do occasionally when they're going in and out of demos. Yeah, like I do the same thing. I usually watch WWDC videos at like 1.5x. And yeah, it does sound a little bit funny. And the people do walk funny when you see them coming on and off. But it's fine, because like, that's the thing. Like, not everything is a masterpiece of art. Like, there are, like, not every video that people watch is a handcrafted piece of film that like has been made by experts who every second counts. Like, a lot of what people watch is like stuff on YouTube. And so to watch some of that at 2x, like, 2x wouldn't be fast enough for a lot of the stuff I find on YouTube. that's
brutal.
And that's, but the same thing is true for podcasts. So many podcasts, like ours, are produced in a casual conversational format where, like, we are not heavily editing this show. We are not scripting this show. Like, if you're listening to one of the big publishers' podcasts, like, every line of what you're listening to from almost all the major podcasts that are produced by like big companies, those are scripted. Almost every single line is scripted. And then it's edited to an inch of its life. Like, they have massive production and writing going into them. Even things that sound off the cuff are usually not on the big shows. They are almost always scripted. And so when you're listening to something like that, like, they can say, oh, we handcrafted all these silences, all these words, all these phrases. You can't gloss over any of this because it was all made intentionally. That isn't true for most podcasts. Most podcasts are done closer to what we're doing here, of just people talking. And they're off the cuff. Maybe they're going off of an outline. Maybe they have a few things they want to say. But for the most part, it's more conversational. That's part of what makes the medium great, I think, is like, people, I think people really appreciate the conversational nature of it. But that is going to also have, by definition, a lot of dead space, a lot of, you know, dead air and phrasing that is wasteful and people repeating themselves like I do all the time. Having something that goes through it faster, you're not missing this marvelous work of art between every single word. You're just hearing conversation a little bit faster. And that's totally fine. Anyway, Thanks to our sponsors this week, Hover, Squarespace, and Fracture. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
Don't install the betas. Oh my God. Why is everyone installing the betas? Why did Apple make this the public beta?
Did you hear that Merlin installed it on his phone and his iPad?
I mean, I did, but that's stupid.
On his main phone. On his, you installed it on your main phone?
Yeah, I waited till beta 2 and I installed it on my main phone. and it totally solved my robocall problem. But it introduced a lot of other problems.
I'm glad you waited till beta 2, which shows that you weren't like, I can't wait, I have to install it. But I think you just waited for the number to go from 1 to 2 and didn't check, hey, is beta 2 actually better than beta 1 in terms of stability? Like, well, it's one more, so I'm installing it. And now you found out, not really.
It's so bad.
I wouldn't even install beta 2 on my iPad. I haven't installed it anywhere. I wanted beta 2 on my iPad, but then I'm like, let me just read about this a little bit. And I said, nah, I'm going to skip that.
Yeah.
I'll wait a little longer.
Let me tell you, people, it's probably already too late for most of you. But if it's not too late, if you're still on the fence and you haven't installed the betas yet, don't install the betas. The public beta is garbage. The public beta should not have been released as a public beta. It is developer beta 2 of everything. That's what it is. And developer beta 2 is terrible. It feels like beta 1 still. Of an average to poor quality year. I have tons of beta problems on my developer beta 2 installs of everything. The iPad is bad. The phone is bad. Catalina, I'm not really using much. I'm only booting into it occasionally, so I don't know how bad it is. But a lot of people are having problems with these betas. These are really rough. You should not be running these. And I do think Apple has done a great disservice by releasing such an incredibly rough set of builds as the public betas.
Just so Merlin doesn't yell at me 4 weeks from now when we record the next episode. Translated from hyperbolic conversational podcast speak, what Marco is saying is that even the very latest builds of the public beta are not particularly stable, and you should be aware of that. He says it as don't install that, but obviously if you need to install it or if you want to install it and just deal with the bugs, we just want you to know what you're getting into. So what we're telling you is that they are not stable and tons of crap doesn't work. If you hear that and say, that's fine, I still want to install it, go for it. Right. But we just want you to be aware that if you have experiences based on iOS 12 beta and you thought, oh, betas aren't that bad, this is more back to the bad old days of iOS 5 where the beta is like barely even functional and basic things don't work. So just so you're aware of that. So when people say don't install the beta, and speaking half to Merlin and half to other people, they're not saying literally, I forbid you to install the beta. By all means, install it if you want to install it. Just be aware. We're providing you information and experience that we either have done it ourselves foolishly or know other people who have done it and have felt the pain. And so now you know, is this a pain that you want in your life? Maybe it is. Maybe you got a spare device. Go crazy. Or maybe not.
Speak for yourself. I actually mean don't install the betas.
All right. Well,
they're really bad.
It's very so, extreme. Marco has banned you from installing the betas, everybody. That's it. I'm sorry. I tried to stop him, but...
Yeah. So like, and there's a number of good reasons why. So first of all, like, and one thing that I didn't even do that I didn't consider, but that a friend of ours remarked the other day that I think is a really good point. Like on iOS, you know, you can always step back from a beta if you like do a full restore with these certain steps. Like you're able to unbeta something, so you kind of have a way out. On macOS, I've mentioned how I do this separate install in a separate APFS volume or partition, whatever they call them. So that way, like, the data stays separate from my Mojave installation. You're doing a dual boot scenario, or some people would do external disks to do that. So you're kind of keeping it separate. But one thing that I didn't consider that I'm always bad at whenever I do this is that iCloud and your iCloud data, your iCloud account, is your primary data volume in a lot of ways. And you are logging into a beta with your iCloud account. You're logging into your main data. And iCloud is especially risky to do this with, because if your iCloud account gets messed up by the beta, there is no time machine for iCloud. There is no recovery for iCloud. You can't just go and like restore your data back to where it was on iCloud. So in a way, logging into your iCloud account on a beta is like the most risky thing you could possibly do to that data, because you are putting it at the whims of the beta world, which is often very unreliable, especially in the early betas, especially with iCloud data, and you can't step it back. Like once that data is touched by the new installation, like that's it. It isn't in its own little separate sandbox. You are dealing with your live and permanent iCloud data with beta software. So if you are going to install the betas, not only should you do it on dedicated hardware, you should also not log into your iCloud account with it. And so you start to think about like what this actually means in practice. Like if it's not on your primary devices and you're not going to log into iCloud from it, what the hell are you going to do with it?
Like, we had the same conversation with Merlin, and I was surprised that people were just thinking of this now, because it's been true as long as iCloud has existed. And that's why I had all those Apple IDs. Remember my big Apple ID saga?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
All those Apple IDs were the Apple IDs that I would use with beta versions of macOS, right? Because I would never use my real Apple IDs. Like, it was worse back in the old days. They would just completely hose your data routinely. And then there was sort of the middle years where the Apple was upgrading the storage format. Do you remember that? Like, they changed the storage format of notes. They moved them from IMAP into like their regular stuff. And sometimes when they, you know, like there would be a one-way back-end transition that if you did transition like your notes on that Apple ID, your other devices could no longer read it, or couldn't read it correctly. Or it's even true today. It's like I'm sitting in front of El Cap on this Mac. I can't see some of the notes that I create on newer operating systems on this Mac. It still works with them, but the notes that are made with like newer features just don't show up at all on this Mac. So if you're going to have beta OSs and you're going to be installing them, have spare Apple IDs. It's kind of a pain in the butt, as I discovered, especially when you decide you don't need them anymore. But that's the safe way to do it. Spare Apple IDs with fake data. And it's like, well, what are you even doing? You're basically doing what I would do for my reviews. You're exploring the operating system in a safe way. It's on a separate volume. It's with separate Apple IDs. You start filling your fake Apple IDs with semi-real data so you can see what it's like. Like, it's no fun, you know, opening up notes and seeing no notes. You don't know how the sync works until you start adding notes and adding pictures to your notes and all that other stuff. But that's definitely the safest way to do it. Now, I have to say, in recent years, Apple has hosed your iCloud data far less often. But since I've always been using spare Apple IDs, I can't say that definitively. Usually what I do is I wait until like the release before the final release, and then I'll put my real Apple ID on a beta system, and usually by then it's fairly safe that they're not going to hose your stuff, but not always. And as for Time Machine for iCloud, it's especially true of big data sets, but for small data sets, you do have an out, and I've used this out a couple of times. For example, contacts lets you save, I think they still call it an address book archive or whatever, lets you save a single archive of all the information. And worst, and it's small, because like how many contacts do you have? Worst case scenario, if iCloud hoses everything, just wipe all of your contacts, wipe it from every single device, wipe it from, you know, just I have zero contacts, and then just restore from the address book archive. Can't do that with 100,000 photos and metadata in your iPhoto library. So, you know, there is no Time Machine. For select sets, there is a way to export or re-import, but in general, use testing Apple IDs and then just deal with the fact that you're going to have 20 Apple IDs that you have to call Apple about 5 years from now.
I really want to put 13 on my iPad, and I do have some travel coming up in a couple of months when presumably whatever beta we're on, if not the released version at that point, will be much more stable.
Install the beta right before you get on the plane. That's the best time to install betas.
That's the right moment.
Traveling with beta software is awesome.
Yeah,
you should be installing it while you're on battery in the airport.
On the airport Wi-Fi.
Oh, man, that's funny. No, but I really want to put it on my iPad really badly. And I have resisted so far, and from everything I've heard even before recording this episode, it sounds like I've made the right call. And usually it's been at least passable by public beta time, and as you're saying, Marco, everything I've heard is that it is not even passable yet, and to stay away, which is what I'm going to be doing.
I made that joke about installing your thing in the airport, but if Casey, if you'll remember, I did, didn't reinstall, I reset my Apple Watch in line at WWDC.
Yes, indeed, I do remember that.
I left the hotel and didn't realize that it was failing to pair with my phone entirely, and I talked to the Apple Watch experts in line around me, aka underscore,
yeah.
And he said, yeah, you just need to reset, you know, erase all data, whatever that option is called, where, you know, reset and erase all data on your watch. And a series zero takes like an hour and a half to do that. Maybe it was 2 hours. And I was looking at him like, is this going to, you know, because I'm not anywhere near a charger. It's just on my wrist. I think it was at least an hour watching that.
It was a long time.
Thing slowly, but it didn't kill the entire battery. It did actually reset everything and pair with my phone again. And I restored a backup from, you know, the last time I had worn my watch, and everything turned out fine.